Science on our website at amos.indiana.edu. To get podcasts, click on the podcast button. For a moment of science, I'm Don Glass.
And I'm Yael Cassander. It's 2:40. Come sort through the thousands of CDs, DVDs, tapes, and albums, plus stereo equipment for sale at Vintage Vinyl this Saturday at Lincoln Square, Urbana. Proceeds benefit Illinois Radio Reader. For sale hours and other information, visit our website at will.illinois.edu. In sports this afternoon, Cliff Lee outpitched Mark Burley, throwing seven innings in Cleveland's 4-0 win today to take 2 of 3 from the Chicago White Sox. The St. Louis Cardinals are in Pittsburgh to continue a 3-game series against the Pirates tonight. The Cards have been struggling on the road against last-place Pittsburgh and dropped last night's series opener 7-1. The Chicago Cubs host the San Diego Padres tonight at Wrigley Field. Chicago is 8-3 this month and has won 5 of 6 at Wrigley. The Cubs will look to win their third straight tonight when they send Ted Lilly to the mound. The Chicago Blackhawks take to the ice today for practice ahead of the conference finals. The Hawks will take on the winner of the Detroit Red Wings-Anaheim Ducks battle going on in Detroit in the Western Conference semifinal series. Game 7 of that series is tomorrow. And Purdue coach Matt Painter has been chosen as one of 2 assistant coaches for the USA Basketball World Championships team. Painter will be part of the U.S. staff during the 16 team tournament, July 2nd through the 12th in New Zealand. That's sports.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Warden Martin Subaru in Savoy. At Subaru's assembly plant in Lafayette, Indiana, a zero landfill status is designed to save cost and our future environment. It is part of what makes a Subaru a Subaru. Information online at wardenmartin.com or 352-8910.
Despite talk of a recovery in higher stock prices, more and more Americans are being forced out of their homes. They can't pay the mortgage. Foreclosure reports usually focus on cities, but as Scott Finn of West Virginia Public Broadcasting reports, rural communities are also being hit by a wave of foreclosure.
67-year-old Nancy Dix lives in a tidy double-wide trailer in rural West Virginia. But after her husband died, she nearly lost her home.
They was going to foreclose on 15, and I was packing up my stuff to move out. I really didn't have any place to go.
Brent Pompanio of Mountain State Justice says he's seen a spike in the number of rural clients such as Dix.
They line up out the door. There's not enough chairs in our waiting room for people that are in urgent need of help because they're about to lose their home.
In West Virginia, there's been a 45% increase in the foreclosure rate in the last year. Most rural areas missed the housing bubble, but many families refinanced into risky subprime loans. Now, Pomponio says, as miners and factory workers lose their jobs, their adjustable mortgage rates are going up.
It's a loan that's unaffordable and they're just scraping to get by and pay on it. If something breaks in any of their sources of income, then the whole thing goes to pot.
Still, according to the Mortgage Bankers Association, 9 of the 10 most rural states have foreclosure rates below the national average, at least for now. For NPR News, I'm Scott Finn in Charleston, West Virginia.
Farmers around Greeley, Colorado are dealing with the collapse of a regional bank. Last month, federal regulators shut down the New Frontier Bank, which closed a major source of financing for farm operations just as spring planting had begun. Kurt Siegler reports from member station KUNC.
Gary Teague grows corn and runs a feedlot near Fort Morgan. It's a small farming town in the High Plains, about 80 miles northeast of Denver. Limbo is how you'd best describe his situation.
How do you buy feed? How do you pay your employees? How do you do those kind of things? It's difficult.
Each spring, Teague relied on a massive loan from New Frontier Bank to finance his farm and 155 employees. He then started to pay it back in the fall when he turned a profit. But with his bank collapsing, he's now under the gun to find a new bank and a new loan before federal regulators dissolve his old one.
I can't plan for next week, much less, the fall. And it's just difficult in that kind of situation.
Teague and a couple hundred other farmers crowded into a 4-H barn at the local fairgrounds this week, hoping to get some answers. They came to hear what the country's top ag official could do to help them through the crisis.
Welcome and good morning to all of you. I'm Tom Vilsack, Secretary of Agriculture.
The secretary came at the urging of several members of Colorado's congressional delegation. They had just gotten him to free up more than $250 million in USDA loan money to help these farmers. But when it was Gary Teague's turn to take the mic, it quickly became apparent that that wasn't going to go far enough.
We've been farming, feeding cattle for 15 years. I don't need a bailout.
What Teague needs, he says, is a bank.
All I'm asking you to do is make a phone call. Just call somebody that matters, because it's our livelihood.
A sympathetic Vilsack said the USDA couldn't help all of these farmers. His agency's loans are geared towards smaller farms with less capital. New Frontier made a lot of loans to big farms. Still, Vilsack pledged to do all he could to buy them some more time.
These people are trying to save their farms, save their homes. And I think, frankly, in difficult times when we're doing everything else to save a lot of folks and help a lot of folks out, the most we can do is try to help these farmers out.
New Frontier's reach was huge. Federal bank regulators say its total portfolio ballooned to $2 billion in just a 10-year run. About a third of those assets were tied up in loans, the bulk farm loans. Up until the bank's collapse, it financed about a third of Colorado's entire dairy market. Vilsack is hoping other regional banks will step in to help these farmers, but many are flinching at taking on New Frontier's loans. One of those banks is Bank of Choice in nearby Greeley. Daryl McAllister is the CEO, and he says he's seen a steady stream of former New Frontier loan customers come through his doors.
Some of it we're able to do.
But McAllister says his bank won't be able to help everyone. He says the amount of loans New Frontier was backing is just too large a sum for other banks to absorb. And he adds, with many of the farm loans, there's another problem.
Some of it we feel the assets were overvalued. Cash flow is not there, and we are not able to offer those loans to those individuals.
All of this isn't very good news for farmers like Gary Teague. He says he's trying to stay upbeat, but he's not doing a very good job.
This is one of the few things that you worry about. You know, this is the last thing you worry about is having to find another financial lending institution in 30 days' time period. You just don't think about that, but these are not normal times.
Indeed, New Frontier was reportedly one of the fastest-growing banks in the country. Now it's become one of the costliest bank failures in the U.S. so far this year. For NPR News, I'm Kirk Sigler.
Coming up today on The World from PRI, in the 1990s, South Americans of Japanese descent flocked to Japan. There were good jobs then at good pay. Now many of these South Americans are unemployed, and Japan wants them to leave. It's even offering to fly them home if they promise never to work in Japan again. A one-way ticket to South America. That's during the day's news coming up today at 3 on The World. Most Illinois residents would probably say they pay too much in taxes. But what is Illinois' true tax burden? As Sean Crawford reports, it all depends on who you ask.
Federal taxes, state taxes, local taxes, and don't forget numerous fees along the way. It's no wonder members of the public feel they pay too much. Some experts agree with them, others don't. Figuring the actual tax burden is not a simple exercise. For example, Illinois' income tax is relatively low, at 3%. But add to that local taxes, especially those on property, and Illinois suddenly takes on a different image. In fact, Illinois ranks among the highest in terms of how much local governments take in.
Every household pays from one pool of money, whether the state's grabbing into your wallet or the local government's grabbing your wallet or the federal government's grabbing your wallet.
John Tillman is the CEO of the Illinois Policy Institute. As state lawmakers consider raising the income tax, Tillman is critical of that plan.
The people of Illinois have been giving this government record revenues, and yet it still isn't enough. There's an insatiable desire for more and more spending, and by some people, for the government to become the central actor in our lives and take on more and more responsibility.
But Tillman and those who side with him are doing battle with others who feel a tax increase is vital to the state being able to provide services from education to health care. A growing budget deficit shows the state is spending more than it takes in. Ralph Martiri is executive director of the Center for Tax and Budget Accountability. He supported an income tax increase for years. Despite the public's disdain for higher taxes, Martiri says Illinoisans get off rather easily, especially when you look at all the taxes and fees paid as a percentage of income. But he says keeping taxes low can have other consequences. Rather than attracting businesses, Martiri says Illinois' tax structure has the opposite effect.
because we don't raise enough in tax revenue to make investments in some very basic things like education, infrastructure, et cetera. And when you're not doing those things, you're not attractive to high-end businesses in a global economy. And if you're not attractive to high-end businesses, the only sort of job growth you will realize in your state's economy is low-wage, low-to-no-benefit service sector jobs. And lo and behold, that's precisely what has happened in Illinois.
Martieri says raising taxes would benefit everyone, but that doesn't mean he signed on completely with Governor Pat Quinn's plan. While Quinn wants income taxes to go up 50%, Martieri says the state should also rework its sales tax so services like a haircut or financial planning are taxed. Services now make up a large part of the state's economy. As for Governor Quinn, his income tax plan would provide a break to those who earn less. He says a family of four earning $60,000 would have taxes reduced. He won't say if Illinois is a high-tax state or a low-tax state, but he does call the current system unfair because it taxes everyone at the same flat rate, regardless of the ability to pay.
Our tax code is one of the most unfair in the country to average people who live from paycheck to paycheck. And that's one of the things I believe in. If we're going to have to deal with raising revenue, we should do it in a fair way.
But Quinn fails to take into account another important aspect. Where someone lives often shapes their views on taxes as much as what they make in salary. In the Chicago area, where high property taxes provide most of the school funding, lawmakers have an especially tough time selling a state tax hike. Hinsdale Republican Senator Kirk Dillard says his constituents want something in return.
I certainly think if the state's going to raise its income tax, we should give corresponding property tax relief. When Governor Jim Edgar kept the income tax from reverting to 2.5%, kept it at 3% back in the early 1990s, for those of us in the Chicago metropolitan area, we received property tax caps, which have helped end double-digit property tax increases.
Taxes and fees are inescapable, from the state's income tax to the cost of a fishing license to the price of a gallon of gas. There's no doubt the state depends on residents to keep government operating, and everyone chips in. But whether or not Illinoisans bear a heavy tax burden is a difficult question to answer. Depending on the formula used, Illinois could be one of the highest taxing states or one of the lowest, and the reality might not always match up with public perception. For Illinois lawmakers, having to predict how raising taxes could be viewed at the polls next election, that perception is the most important factor of all. I'm Sean Crawford.
The internet has made it easier to mistake one person for another, sometimes with unfortunate results. Commentator Amy Guida explains in this week's edition of Legal Issues in the News.
My name is Amy Guida. My last name is spelled G-A-J-D-A. Now, you might think that I'm the only Amy Guida in the United States, given my not-so-popular first name and the rather odd spelling of my last. But I'm not. There's another Amy Guida out there. She lives in Michigan, my home state, but she's no relation that I know of. The internet has made information about both of us readily available. Someone can do a search for my name and come up with information about her. Find one Amy Guida and you may stop searching, even though there's another one, the right one, just a few hits down. There are many other twin-named people out there like us, of course. The trouble comes when the someone doing an internet search is a journalist who assumes that you, a law-abiding John Smith, are the same John Smith who was just arrested for murder. If your name is unusual enough, the journalist may assume the worst without looking to see if there's another fellow with your name, especially if you're from the same area. I read a couple of weeks ago, for example, about the poor woman with a relatively uncommon name that matches that of a second woman arrested for a shocking murder. I won't repeat the name because I don't want to burden her even more, but some news organizations found the innocent Jane Doe's MySpace page and published her MySpace photo on the internet, assuming that she was the same Jane Doe that police had arrested. They also used the innocent Jane Doe's yearbook photo from 10 years before to illustrate news stories about the murder. By the time the innocent Jane Doe recognized the problem and posted key information about the mistake, vigilantes had already left multiple death threats on her MySpace page. Those who'd recognized that there'd been some sort of mistake left more helpful comments, suggesting that she sue somebody. If the law-abiding Jane Doe takes that advice, she could well win. I can predict that because the mistake isn't that unusual. Just ask Anthony Lucuri from Massachusetts. A newspaper named him and gave his street address in a story about another Anthony Lucuri's admitted robberies. Ditto the federal prosecutor in Virginia, whose photo appeared in an article with another with the same last name who'd been indicted. And the honor student in Illinois, who found his photo in a how far they've fallen sort of story about a guy with the same name arrested for dealing drugs. You get the picture. The jurisdiction and the precise facts make a difference. Whether the person wronged is a public figure, whether the journalist got the photo from police, for example. But many times, all that the private person has to show is that the news media was negligent in some way in assuming that the good Jane Doe was the bad Jane Doe. So while the woman with the same name as one arrested for murder suffers through her unfortunate infamy, she should take heart that others with same names have walked that path before and found understanding judges and juries at its end. I'm Amy Guida.
Amy Guida is an assistant professor of journalism and law at the University of Illinois.
Earth and sky.
We have to have drastic CO2 emission reductions on the order of 80% by 2050 if we're to avoid serious impacts on our ocean ecosystems.
You're listening to Richard Feely of the Pacific Marine Environmental Laboratory in Seattle. He said Earth's oceans are absorbing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, making the oceans more acidic. This could pose a threat to ocean life.
Particularly our shellfish, lobster and crab and clams and oysters and even the basis of the food chain, the plants and marine zooplankton that are food for our fish, produce calcium carbonate skeletons and shells.
Feely said that acidity is weakening these shells and skeletons and could eventually prevent some marine creatures from growing them at all.
Throughout the world, our fisheries resources represent about 20% of the protein resources for about a third of the population of the world. And so we're concerned that many of our fisheries resources would be impacted.
Feely emphasized the global consequences of ocean acidification.
These problems are serious, but they can be avoided as long as we make a concerted effort to reduce CO2 emissions. We need to do that within the next couple of decades.
Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
This is WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana. We're broadcasting from Campbell Hall for public telecommunication, thanks to a generous gift from Robert and Alice Campbell. It's 2 minutes before 3 o'clock. Heavy rainfall of 1.5 to 3 inches fell.